Science Faction is meant for an adult audience. All likeness to persons living or dead are the result of purposeful slander.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello! And welcome to Science Faction 235, Science Faction Ichnology.
This one doesn't sound real. It sounds like you're saying acknowledging and mispronouncing it, or you're mispronouncing psychology, which is the study of dope-ass beats.
Damien, I need you to acknowledge me.
I'm forced to.
I was going to go with itchnology.
Okay, because it is spelled out. It's I-C-H-N-O-L-O-G.
Yeah.
What does an itchnologist, what does he study? Chicken pox?
No. Like
mosquito bites?
Middle-aged dudes at a baseball game with their hands in their pants. That's,
yeah. Yep.
I said deep ichnology study. No, this is indeed the study of fossilized tracks and burrows. So this is kind of an interesting thing. It's something I run into every once in a while as an archaeologist, which is you imagine that not only do we have burrowing animals now, like ground squirrels and all this stuff, but we've had them for quite a long time. And when those animals burrow, they create a hole through the natural strata, the natural dirt, and then, you know, they die or something, and eventually that hole gets filled in. And the same way fossils get fossilized by minerals, these will a lot of times get essentially fossilized by the stuff around them. Now, it's not always a true fossilization. A lot of times, instead of actually getting mineralized, they get filled in with different sediments, and you can tell the difference between them. But it's really interesting because you do a cutaway of a one-by-one unit that we dig for archaeology, and sometimes you'll see what looks like a tube, like almost like a pipe going through it, and it's a fossilized or a filled-in burrow or tunnel from an animal.
I can't imagine any grad student finding the study of burrows to be interesting, which leads me to believe that this is a punishment major forced upon students who irritate the dean.
Yeah, well, so there's two ways into this. This is one of those weird sciences that has two branching points. So there's two different main sciences that usually come in to study this particular one. One is from geology. So if you're a geology expert and you're looking at the different soil and the different stratotypes, this can be really important for telling where inclusions are, where things have happened that have kind of traversed one boundary into another. So it's part of a geology spectrum, especially geomorphology and geophysicists, but also a different group comes at it from paleontology. And what they're looking at is not its effect on the overall geology. They're looking at what they can tell about that animal. Mm-hmm. We covered a really interesting story about a year
ago. It digs.
Done.
All right, well, it's clearly a digger.
Yeah. We covered a story about a year ago that was really interesting about them finding a burrow in South America that was like 12...
That's a donkey? Like, is that...
Yes, it was a burrow. Yeah, not to be confused with a mule.
It was a burrito that had gotten just like rocket launched and then made a hole in the earth.
And then it filled in later on.
Yeah.
No, it was a 12-foot wide burrow that was like 100 some odd feet deep, and it was from some kind of burrowing giant ground sloth, and they still had the claw marks on the inside. So in that case, that's really a paleontology thing where they come in, they want to see what they can tell about this animal, how it lived, how it dug this hole, all that kind of stuff. Whereas if you were a geophysicist working for an oil company and somebody saw one of these burrow tracks and was confused about what it meant about the age or strata or composition of the rock, mm-hmm. that would be more of the geology side of it. So it's interesting because it's one of these things where instead of a one linear form of going from, okay, I went to grad school in geology and now I'm doing this, this, and this, you actually have two different routes into this.
It makes a lot of sense because this phenomenon is like the intersection of rock with living things,
right?
So it's like, depends on...
I always thought that was the Fantastic Four member, the Thing. Yeah. But thank you. Yes. You have corrected me.
Right. Well, he could potentially make a burrow. Right?
Little known fact, he was actually an ichnologist. Ben Grimm.
You call that a burrow? Move out of the way, giant ground sloth. It's clobbering time.
It's digging time. And it occasionally pops up in archaeology because we do have instances, we call them bioturbation, where animals actually change the strata of the site. So you have something where, let's say you have defined layers. Okay, this is down in the archaic period and it's 5,000 years old, and then we have another site that's 2,000 years old right on top of it in the late prehistoric and blah, blah, blah. You can actually have ground burrowing animals go down and take artifacts from one part because they're kicking the dirt back up. Mm-hmm. So they'll move artifacts from one part of the site to another through the different strata, and it can be very confusing if you don't know what you're looking at.
I suppose that makes a lot more sense than what I pictured, which is a mole decorating his living room with this...
Yeah. He's got a little TV, yeah. But it's made out of a cell phone, yeah. And he's positioned.
Here's the thing. You can't even see that well. Why do you need these things?
Yeah. You don't need decorations at all. I was picturing a modern day dog finds a bone and it happens to be an important archaeological artifact. Dog doesn't care. He's just digging a hole and finds a bone. He wants to bury it somewhere else. And then strata ruined.
That's easier to tell because if it's a modern day thing, usually you can very easily see the intrusion into the different layers. When it's old, sometimes these things can be tens of thousands of years old. Mm-hmm. It can look like a natural part of the formation. You don't realize that this is tens of thousands of years old, but it's through sediments that are hundreds of thousands of years old. So it's a more modern intrusion. Right. And so that can be a little confusing. But regardless, that is a study that indeed, as Damien pointed out, nobody of importance bothers with.
We're covering all sciences here. If I'm an ichnologist, this is the only time my science has ever been referenced. And on a podcast who reaches, according to iTunes comments page, at least 32 people.
Nope, 7.5 billion, Damien.
I just tuned in for one segment, though.
By the way, I am disappointed, Damien, that you didn't comment about an ichnologist being somebody who studies incest, and everybody's just like, ick.
Fair enough, Bobby. All right,
Not gross enough. Grosser.
My notes for into the show, I'm taking out more incest.
And speaking of incest, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. And with me, as always, is my brother, Mr. Damien Mercado.
That's right, brother Bobby. Now, please, receive this deep mouth kiss.
And our scientist for the evening, Bill. Bill, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I went on a hike with my cousin this morning. And
what'd you do together?
We made burrows. There was no incest.
Fuck yeah, bro.
And you can check out burrows of your own on our website, www.thesciencefaction.com, and tweet us at Faction Science. Let us know some more ungoogleable questions. That is our favorite new bit. I love doing it. We've had some really, really good suggestions. We actually skipped this one just to get some science articles in. We're coming back next week with it, but please send in good ones. Remember to be specific. I gotta tell you, we've gotten a lot of good ones, but for every one we get that's really good and detailed, we get like 5 or 6 that are like, what's the biggest animal ever? And it's just like, it's the blue whale. All right, we're done. It was Googleable. I finished it. Good job.
If you tweeted us a suggestion and we didn't get back to you, it's because you're not supposed to insult your fans. So
there is such thing as a bad question.
There are so many, and I have an email box full of them. But please send them anyway. Just be specific. Yeah. That's the big thing. Be specific. Think of something that is cognitive rather than definitive, something that is a little bit subjective rather than objective. Take a look at some of our previous ones. We've had some really good suggestions from fans that we've done, so go ahead and check that out. But for now, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
Article number one, does Alzheimer's come from herpes?
Holy shit, my Ta lived a lot cooler of a life than I thought he did.
I guess Ta is grandfather.
Yeah, but it's kind of tragic what's happening right now, but learning this knowledge made me say, hey, Ta used to fucking party.
not just that, but I think that speaks really poorly for everybody who's ever been on spring break. Their future is very bleak.
But hey, granddad fucking tore it up in his 20s.
Now, we're not actually talking about HSV 1 or 2, which are, oral and genital herpes, respectively. This is actually something a little bit different. This is a form of herpes called HHV6 and HHV7, and oddly ubiquitous. In fact, it causes a disease called roseola, which is like a childhood disease, which is basically a body infection. You see it happen on the trunk, basically the body of the baby, and then eventually spread out to the limbs. And it looks like a rash. It's highly contagious. And what shocked me is when I looked this up, a huge, huge infection frequency of 90%. 90% of children under the age of 2 have caught this, which is crazy because I've actually personally never heard of this until now. So this particular infection is in that herpes family. And you might say, well, wait, how would this thing that affects apparently 90% or more of children, of people around us, how could this possibly be the cause? Well, they weren't looking for this to be the cause. This was a group of Alzheimer's researchers who were looking at the brains of Alzheimer's patients, and they kept noticing a constant correlation between Alzheimer's, really bad Alzheimer's, and the frequency of the viral DNA of this particular herpes virus within the brains of these people. So
wait, somebody has to finish on that part of the brain or something?
Yeah, that's the way it works. It's all from blowjobs. It's from incredibly powerful blowjobs. You have to pierce the back of the throat, get into the spinal fluid.
There was a really good quote from presumably one of the scientists in that article. quote, I went looking for drugs and all I found were these stupid viruses.
Yeah, like, they weren't looking for a virus correlation. They were looking for a drug that could affect the Alzheimer's, and they ended up seeing this, because they're like, oh, why do we have to keep seeing herpes all the time?
Damn it.
Yeah, and so what they found was...
Greatest generation, my ass.
Like we're saying, it's not that everybody who gets this has Alzheimer's, otherwise 90% of people would have Alzheimer's or more. What they're saying is, when we looked at the brains of these people, we found that the people who had... And again, these are postmortems, so they're actually dissecting the brain. When we looked at the brains of people who had Alzheimer's during their lifetime, we found that they had a really high frequency of this particular virus within their brains. Other people had this virus, had it contracted, and again, with the viruses like this, think of regular herpes, think of HIV, you have it for life. It's with you for life, and it will frequently come back when you're old in things like shingles, when your immune system is low. But what they're saying is, yes, the people who died of Alzheimer's seem to have a higher, much higher viral load in their brains than the other people who had contracted this and not died of Alzheimer's. They just had a regular amount. Mm-hmm. Now, that could be one of two things. One is this hypothesis that this virus has something to do with Alzheimer's, and not necessarily just this virus, but viruses and infections in general. We know that with Alzheimer's patients, there's something called amyloid beta plaques, or we just call them plaques, that are in the brain, and they're a telltale sign of Alzheimer's disease. But we don't know that they're the cause or the effect. You know, they're correlated with something else. One of the ideas, we used to think that it was just bad. Oh, these plaques are bad. Now, one of the ideas that's growing in the epidemiological community is that these plaques are actually an ability for us to resist infection. They're kind of things that are in our brain that stop both viral and bacterial infections from getting in there. But they can grow out of control, much like an autoimmune response that gets too strong. Basically, the idea would be you get some kind of infection, in this case, this particular HHV infection, then those plaques grow out of control, causing a neurodegenerative disease. So it is possible, and there is a framework and a way that this can work, that a viral infection could lead to something like Alzheimer's disease.
That sounds possible, but I don't know that I buy it personally, because my mouth is covered in plaque.
Right.
I found that it only promotes infections.
That's true.
In my mouth.
That is true. Yeah, well, your whole never brush and always kiss dudes with herpes thing is really kicking you back.
The heart wants what the heart wants, Bobby.
You would still have to, at that point, explain, well, if that is the case and this virus is causing that effect, why is it only causing it in some people and not the 90% that are infected? And as we know, all disease basically is a mixture of nature and nurture. So you are going to have some genetic predisposition to have these plaques grow out of control, or to have a unregulated response to them. Maybe it's when you get infected. Maybe it's the type of infection. Maybe it's all these other things that contribute it. But what they're saying is this could be one of the underlying causes. Now, let me play devil's advocate for a second. It doesn't mean that's necessarily the case. We can see this beautiful correlational graph. Everything can look exactly how it does. And it could be that the case is there is one disease or some underlying cause that causes a compromised immune system that both allows this childhood virus to take over your body and infect your brain really badly later, and also leads to Alzheimer's disease. So we could be seeing a correlational rather than a causational issue. But this is still really interesting because it is a hint at what might be causing it. It is either that this is one of the causes of Alzheimer's disease and this is something we need to look into, or it is hinting at a broader cause of both this and Alzheimer's disease that, again, is another clue to link to what might be causing it.
Another thing this reminded me of was in diet or nutrition, there's the idea of triage theory where...
Okay.
Your body will emphasize things that can kill you sooner over things that can kill you long term.
Okay.
So like it could be that these extra amyloid beta plaques will prevent you from dying from something that will kill you in a few years. But
right.
Then when you get to be 70 or 80, evolution hasn't controlled for that as well.
Yeah.
And so
but
the
you
amyloid
still run
beta
in...
plaques that are there because they're protecting from something else then lead to this thing later on.
You still run into the idea, though, of why is it that we have a 90% infection rate and not a 90% Alzheimer's rate. So you would still have to differentiate some kind of compounding factor that would cause some people to get it and not.
Bit of a side question here. Why isn't there a vaccine for herpes? Or what is the best way that we could see in the future that we are going to tackle diseases like this?
They are actually working on a vaccine for herpes. They've been in test trials for a long time. One of the problems when you're doing these vaccines is the same problem when you're doing a vaccine for HIV, which is you have to be very careful. You cannot use any kind of live viral strain because it's a lifelong infection. And so if you try to give somebody a vaccine and it's a live virus vaccine and it doesn't work and they end up contracting the disease, it's not just a cold or flu. You have it for the rest of your life.
But it's slightly less risk with herpes, right? Because if 90% of people are getting it anyways, then the risk is
well, like, this is for a childhood form. Again, this is not really what we would consider herpes. This isn't HSV 1 or 2. This is
But those are also really high. Like, it's like
they
50,
are
50%.
They are. They are pretty high. They are working on some stuff. They actually have some really interesting vaccines that not only seem to work in the trials. I think they're in animal trials right now. With the typical vaccine would, with somebody who hasn't been exposed to the particular virus, they seem to show effectiveness in those already infected. So you're actually training your immune system to fight something that's already in your body. We'll see when that comes out a little bit more. You also have to realize that a lot of times it's not going to be as interesting research. The guy wants to cure cancer. He doesn't want to cure cold sores. You know, there right. is that push in science that even though there's a huge frequency of things like HSV 1 and 2, and it would be a huge advantageous thing to fix that, especially genital herpes, which can lead to other STDs like HIV that are more dangerous, or hepatitis, because they cause open sores and open wounds. It would be really useful to get rid of these. They're just not as, like, in a weird way, they're not as sexy as the other, as cancer, you know?
But here's the thing. I imagine thousands of scientists working on that I cured cancer.
Yeah.
They all want to be the Jonas Salk of curing cancer.
Right.
But nobody's taking out these super slutty and available prom date sitting right in front of you. Nobody's trying to be the Jonas Salk of cold sores.
Yeah. They'll put his name on every Tijuana brothel. Now, we should note that there is absolutely a genetic component to Alzheimer's disease. We know for sure this is not just an external thing because we see the data. We can actually monitor certain alleles that seem to be indicative of Alzheimer's disease, or at least the predisposition to it. And interestingly enough, it looks like this might interact with some of those. So we can see certain elements of this being just how you're born, your genes, you can't control it. Certain elements, you're infected before you're 2 years old. Again, you can't control it. But then when you're old, you now are suffering from the disease in the end. Now, even if we figure out that this is the case, let's say we figure out that, yes, you have to have the genetic predisposition, and so that's why the genetics work out, but you have to be exposed to this particular virus, either HHV 6 or 7, in order to get Alzheimer's disease. That would be great news, except how do we fix the problem when we have a 90% infection rate? And one of the things might be recognizing this as a more serious disease, because right now it's just seen as one of those, it's like chickenpox. It's something you get when you're a kid, no big deal. It just is. And we don't take it seriously. It might mean that later on in life, you have a very hard time. It can shorten your lifespan and certainly make the last part of it very, very bad if it leads to Alzheimer's disease. So we would have to suddenly start quarantining these kids and keeping them from spreading and making this a very serious public health issue.
On the other hand, there's been a lot of news that we're making big strides in treating or curing Alzheimer's, preventing it. If we solve that problem, can't we just seawalk in this virus's face, you know, like make it rain dollar bills? Like, we don't give a shit.
I mean, we're kind of doing that now because we don't think of it's a big deal. Like, kids get the thing and it's just they have like a little flu and then they're fine again. So we don't really treat it as a big deal now. I don't know if I would use the term seawalking in its face, but
the worm, whatever.
But yeah, it would be interesting to see if we did, let's say tomorrow, a slew of high quality follow-up studies all come out and they all seem to indicate that, yes, you have to get this virus. Well, what do we do? How do we change public policy in order to protect kids? Because kids are still going to be in daycare with what is an incredibly infectious and incredibly frequent disease. How do we suddenly say as a society, we're going to make this priority number one? Like, do you wrap your kid in a condom before you drop him off at daycare?
This is probably one of those things where there's no obvious solution, and it'll probably take someone stumbling upon a fix. Like, maybe through genetic engineering, you can give everyone sort of a gene that will help you fight this virus.
Yeah, or a vaccine. Maybe a vaccine, you know, that we can give before two that would be able to prevent infection even at that young age. Yeah.
We can't even prevent children with lice from coming to school. Which, how the fuck do you, like, who's, yes, the only way to get lice is from a kid who went to school with somebody, but where is the source kid getting the lice from? And why is this continually a problem?
Listen, for the last time, I'm sorry I gave all you guys lice.
Just shave everyone's head.
Yeah.
It's not our head.
All right, on to article number 2, a link between white pigment and diabetes. Another really interesting medical linkage story.
It's all those white diabetics. Yeah. Typical white man disease, diabetes.
It's another one of those correlational discoveries with a very interesting finding. In this case, a super small N number. So everybody, from the moment we go from here on out, I want you to be very skeptical. We're talking about incredibly preliminary findings. I want you to just let this sink in. N number of 11. There's 11 individuals in this study, so keep that in mind.
So the N number was 11, but the sign is still fairly strong because all 8 of the of the samples that had type 2 diabetes, they found the titanium dioxide. And all 3 of the samples that did not have type 2 diabetes, they did not find dioxide.
And for what we know, titanium dioxide, which is what we're talking about, the white pigment element, it's something that we've used for at least 50 years, though more in some circumstances. We use it in everything from paint to toothpaste, sunscreen, medication, foods, cosmetics, plastics, paper. We use it in a lot of things to basically give them that white coloring.
Is it possible that all the people tested, because they all tested positive, that while they had them lined up, they just left a bowl of titanium dioxide in the middle of the room and these fatties just couldn't help themselves? So, of course, testing comes,
they had type 2 diabetes.
Just like sugar.
Yeah, you just it's powdered sugar. Maybe it's just on the donuts, on powdered donuts. That's what that is.
This sugar tastes terrible as they don't stop.
So they found it in the pancreas of the 8 people who had type 2 diabetes, but not in the 3 people who didn't. Now, we don't have any reason for this to be in our bodies. As far as we know, there's no natural production element of titanium dioxide. There's no reason it should be in your body. This is almost certainly environmental contamination. Now, here's the thing. Bill, you are right that it is 100% correlated in this tiny sample with 8 of the people who were tested found titanium dioxide who also had type 2 diabetes, and 3 of the people who didn't have type 2 diabetes didn't have it. However, with something this small, you also need to understand the frequency of the greater population, because it could be that it's just something that 90% of people, like we're talking about with the infection rate, maybe 90% of people have this in their pancreas.
Right.
They looked at it and the things about worked out, or 80% or something. You know, maybe that's just the way it is and the numbers happen to work out. In a sample size this small, I would imagine that P number is actually pretty high, because I don't think it's only a 5% chance that this would be due to chance. Yeah. And so it is very promising. But we want to see what the frequency is in the broad population and then do more detailed analysis to see what the frequency is specifically among type 2 diabetes.
I imagine that just from a perspective of someone who's trying to publish papers currently, these scientists have probably been thinking about this for a while, and then they've already formulated a hypothesis and had a bunch of anecdotal evidence. So they're probably fairly convinced, and then did this pilot study to prove that there is something there so that they could then do a larger study.
And in juxtaposition, for instance, to the last study we talked about where they were very surprised to see the correlation.
Yeah, they just happened upon it.
What are the odds that the entire sample came from a town whose primary employer was the titanium dioxide mine?
Yeah, that's the other
actually
thing.
A really good point.
Yeah, it is a good point. Because
there's a mine for that stuff?
No, but it's because this is such a small localized sample that it really could be an environmental contamination
issue. For example, in the last study, they took 3 separate cohorts of samples from different locations to kind of control for that bias in
like
the
different
data.
Parts of town?
different areas of the country.
Let's do correlational analysis even more. You know, if you think about it, who's really likely to get type 2 diabetes? Not only people of certain ethnic groups, but it's really highly prevalent in certain lower socioeconomic groups. Who's more likely to be working with industrial heavy metals? People in lower socioeconomic groups. Maybe we're seeing a correlation based on lifestyle choices that both lead to type 2 diabetes and getting titanium dioxide in your pancreas. Or it could be, and this is another one, maybe something about type 2 diabetes causes you to absorb titanium dioxide from your environment in a different manner. So again, we're seeing a correlational thing where type 2 diabetes is the cause of you absorbing more titanium dioxide. It's not that titanium dioxide is the cause of your type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way we could see the levels inside of, for example, a rich hipster who ironically works in an industrial job?
I have a forge in my backyard. At first, I built it to make swords, but I don't agree with weapons of war, so now I just make shields.
I would love it if he just made some tiny part, we make ball bearings for Cessnas.
It is really, really interesting. We do know, obviously, that type 2 diabetes is a lifestyle disease. We're not saying that having bad diet and poor exercise is not going to cause type 2 diabetes. It absolutely is. What this study is suggesting is there might also be other causes. It also might be that what we consider to be type 2 diabetes as one big, broad, over-scoping thing is actually, in some cases, the result of diet and exercise and genetic factors, and in another case, the result of exposure to heavy metals that cause a similar damage to the pancreas, that cause similar effects, and we group them as type 2 diabetes, but in fact, one of them is diet, exercise, life-related genetic cause, and the other is exposure to this particular metal.
We've talked on previous episodes about diabetes 3 or 4
diabetes 3.
Hepatitis.
Yes, type 3 diabetes, which is something that is basically just discovered. It's a subset of a very specific type of diabetes that seems to be, I think, 5 to 10% of other diabetic classifications are actually this particular thing. We might find out that this is a lot of different things. I mean, we're finding that out more and more. We're finding out that schizophrenia is multiple different diseases that do different things that we see as kind of being the same, but it's actually a conglomeration of a bunch of things.
Also, the pancreas is kind of weird, yeah. Right? Like we don't know very much about, I mean, we know a lot compared to, you know, tens of years ago, but still are nowhere close to being able to definitively say what happens when the pancreas gets this contaminant or that contaminant and how does it affect other things.
The nice thing about pancreas is it's right now, I think other than the bladder, the easiest organ to replicate mechanistically. So right now we have these things which are basically, you know, like sprinkler timers that you can set to water your lawn every once in a while. We can do that where we implant something in your body that essentially has insulin. It's got like a sprinkler timer on it and it puts it out in regular, both just in regular amounts and then also when it has sensors that indicate when your blood sugar is too high. So we can replicate this pretty easily. I think by our kids' era, diabetes type 1 or 2 won't be an issue anymore because everybody just have fake pancreases.
Couldn't you argue that a hand is easy to replicate? You know, and like,
it's not an organ.
You could use a like as a hook, and especially like if your job was to hook something, like you know, you just got a big upgrade.
That's true. So again, this study is way too small to conclude anything, except that we need future studies to come in. We need a lot more testing to see if this particular thing is an environmental contaminant that causes this. And if so, we need to think about what we're doing with this, because this is pretty ubiquitous in our day-to-day lives in the first world, especially in the United States. And we've used it to replace what we thought was even more dangerous elements, like
street
lead.
Gangs.
No, we had this helps replace lead in white paint.
Street
this
is gangs that carry weapons made of lead.
Yeah. This is my lead pipe. I'm not going to hit you with it, but I will have you suck on it for a long period of time.
We coated these bats in roseola.
I'll give you Alzheimer's and lead poisoning. So, you know, we might have replaced one dangerous thing, i.e. lead, with something else that's dangerous, i.e. titanium dioxide. Though I would say with its ubiquitousness in the environment and the fact that we don't see the skewing of type 2 diabetes to people with generally healthy lifestyles, you know, there are a few people who are healthy and fit who still contract type 2 diabetes, but that is very rare. It is almost completely correlated with lifestyle issues.
When they, like on their cheat days, they cheat.
Yeah. I cheat. By eating other people with diabetes.
Oh my God.
That was better than my answer.
And the guy who found this out, by the way, was really interesting. He's got an interesting backstory. He's the guy who invented Freestyle, which is this form of...
Damn, yo. Run DMC?
No, it's this diabetic testing thing that you basically... It's painless diabetic testing, and it was a big deal. It's a multi-million dollar industry now, and so he's both very wealthy and very well-versed in this.
Are there commercials where, like, you're using the Freestyle to test like your blood level while freestyling?
Yeah, that would be perfect. And the guy's doing Freestyle BMX. He's doing some sweet Superman moves.
Freestyle Frisbee moves.
Yeah, very, very interesting stuff. Those are two stories that we need to keep our eyes on because it is about the future of our health and some very, very interesting correlational studies that, again, not provably causational yet, but some very interesting stuff that may come out in the future. One of those places that you should keep your eyes on. And make sure you keep your eyes on us for our latest episode coming out this Thursday. Until then, thank you, Bill, for joining us. And thank you, audience, for coming out, where you learned about ichnology, how Alzheimer's might be caused by herpes, and a link between white pigment and diabetes. Thank you so much for joining us. And come on back this Thursday for Science Faction 236.
So wait, if white pigment causes diabetes, does that mean black pigment causes skin cancer?
You've been listening to Science Function. Wait, that's not right.